Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is Claire Fuller, the author of the new novel Swimming Lessons, which has been described by The Guardian as compelling and subtle, and Claire is here to tell us why that is. Claire, welcome to the show.
Hi, hello.
If you wouldn't mind starting out just giving a brief description of the plot of Swimming Lessons.
So it's the story really of Ingrid Coleman, who writes letters to her husband, but instead of giving them to him, she hides them in the books that he collects. And he collects thousands of books for their marginalia and the things that people leave behind. And then she disappears off her Dorset beach, which is in South England, and nobody knows what's happened to her. And interspersed with the letters that the reader reads is the kind of present day, 12 years later, when Gil, the husband, believes that he's seen Ingrid from a bookshop window. And he has an accident which calls back his two adult daughters to the family home, Nan and Flora. And Flora wants answers to what's happened to her mother. Finally, she starts asking questions, and without realizing that actually the answers are in all the books that surround her in the house. So very briefly, that's what it's about.
Would you mind reading a little bit from the beginning of the book, please?
Yeah, sure. Gil Coleman looked down from the first floor window of the bookshop and saw his dead wife standing on the pavement below. He had been among the shelves all afternoon, thumbing through the second-hand books from front to back, pausing at folded-over corners or where the text had been underlined, flicking through the pages to persuade them to offer up what might be hiding between the leaves. The cup of tea that Viv had brought for him had cooled, forgotten on the window seat. At about 3 o'clock, he had picked up Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead, a book he recognised and thought he might already own. It had fallen open, and there, tucked between the pages, he had been surprised to see a folded sheet of thin yellow paper with faint blue lines. Trembling, Gil had sat down beside the cup and turned the book sideways so he could open the note without removing it. One of his rules was that the things he found must never be taken out from their original location. He lifted both the book and the piece of paper up to the rain-streaked window. It was another letter, handwritten in black ink, and when he squinted, he could read the date, 2nd of July 1992, 2:17 p.m., and, under that, his own name. The text below that was smaller, and the writer had paid no attention to the lines provided, but had allowed their writing to slope downhill as if they had written it at speed. He patted the breast of his jacket, swapped the book to his other hand and dipped into the inside pockets, then tapped the sides of his trousers. No reading glasses. He moved the letter nearer and further away from his face to bring the writing into focus and leaned closer to the window. The light was poor. The storm that had been forecast for Saturday had arrived a day early. When Gil had locked his car in the car park beside the Jurassic Crazy Golf playground, he saw that the wind had wrapped a plastic bag around one of the front claws of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, so that the creature appeared to be about to step over the wire fence on its way to do some shopping. And as Gil had walked along the promenade to the bookshop, the wind had gouged troughs in the grey sea and flung the top edges of the waves towards the land, so that now, standing amongst the old books, he could taste salt on his lips. A blast of rain rapped on the window, and that was when he turned to look out and down to the narrow street below. On the pavement opposite, a woman in an oversized greatcoat stood gazing along the road. Only the tips of her fingers showed from the ends of the sleeves, and the bottom hem came almost to her ankles. The coat was a dirty olive colour from the rain, the cast of the sea after a shower, and it occurred to Gil that his daughter Flora would know the colour's proper name. The woman pushed a strand of wet hair off her face with the back of her wrist and turned towards the bookshop. The gesture was so shockingly familiar that Gil stood up and was unaware of knocking over his cup of tea. The woman tilted her heart-shaped face to look up, as if she knew Gil was watching, and in that moment he understood that the woman was his wife. Older, but without doubt, he thought her. The rain had flattened and darkened her hair, and the water dripped off her chin, but she stared at him in the same defiant way she had when he had first met her. He would have known that expression and that woman anywhere. Ingrid.
Wonderful, thank you. I'd like to talk first about the two main female characters in the book. I know there's technically three, but the two I want to talk to you about are Flora and Ingrid, and Flora being Ingrid's daughter. And the two of them reminded me of characters in other books, like the main character in Emma Klein's The Girls and the main female protagonist in Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, in that they seem to exist outside what's going on around them or happening to them. They almost seem like anthropologists studying a new species of human by their thought process, by their actions, the way Ingrid, in her letters, we learn that she defies Gil and does her own thing and builds her own life separate of his. Where did the pathology come from for these characters that leaves them sort of outside the goings-on of their lives?
That's quite an interesting way of looking at it. I think that kind of came about rather than it was something deliberate. I mean, an awful lot of what I write is not particularly deliberate. It kind of creates itself in a kind of a way. So it's quite hard to answer that, really, because these characters arrive and develop, and then they do become kind of very real to me. And they have characteristics that I don't necessarily even put on the page. And so I try and make them do things and they won't particularly do what I want them to do because they have become a complete character. So maybe, you know, that I don't know that it came from anywhere. It kind of came as I was creating them, really.
Do they start out as complete characters or do you discover who they are as you write the book?
Oh, I very much discover who they are as I write the book. Yes, I don't do any kind of character sheets in advance or anything like that. I kind of do that a little bit as I go along. And sometimes when I get stuck, you know, I'm halfway through and I don't know what on earth is happening or what's going to happen next and who these people are. Then I'll open up another sheet and I'll kind of interrogate them. And I always start my sheets, those kind of sheets, with "we need to talk about" and whatever it is. And then I almost have a conversation with them on paper and discover a bit more about them. But that's usually when I'm quite a long way through the book, when they're just not doing what I want them to do.
Right. I'd like to talk a little bit about the choice in the half the book is told in letters, and then the other half of the book is told in regular present day prose. Regarding the letters, they're told from Ingrid's point of view 12 years earlier, as you said. Why choose to tell them in letters as opposed to using just flashbacks?
First of all, really, because I had got to the stage where I knew that this woman had disappeared, and I wanted to hear her voice. And I could have done it in flashbacks, but I want, because she is a writer, although kind of an unpublished, undiscovered one, I wanted her to be doing some writing. And although they are letters, they are directed to Gil. They start with "Dear Gil" and they sign off as Ingrid. I almost see them as kind of journal entries. They're a way of her discovering how her life has been and what she wants to happen in the future. And she makes some quite bad choices, I think. But so although they're framed as letters, they could almost just be kind of the workings of her mind and she's writing them down. But then it was fun to make them letters so that she directs them at Gil, and it kind of added to the intrigue, and fun then also to hide them in books, and it all became kind of a whole literary thing in itself.
You mentioned her history as a writer, and she meets her husband, Gil. He's a professor at her university, and they fall in love. And after falling in love and getting married and having a child, she leaves that part of her life. She leaves university just before her degree is finished. And it seems in the quality of her letters, she's not just writing to Gil, but she's trying to prove to him that she never gave up that part of her. Mm-hmm. Because there isn't... it's not just that they're letters, but the quality of the letters and the prose inside, I understand that it's also a book and you need to retain a certain style as well, but there's a definite attention to the words she chooses and the metaphors and the imagery she uses in those letters.
Yeah, they almost aren't like people would write letters, because she does relate whole sections of dialogue in them, which isn't the way that people normally write letters. They kind of paraphrase things and pracy stuff. So yeah, I wanted them to be more than normal letters, and so that we can kind of get really inside her head and she can show herself and Gil that yes, she hasn't left that side of herself behind. She's still capable of it.
I got the sense that completeness was a big part of the story with Ingrid. They have children, but she never wanted them. She had this idea for a new life where she would travel and pal around with her friend Louise all throughout Europe. And there's a point in the book where they suffer a miscarriage and she feels relieved. But at the same time, there's this lashing out in the car where she screams at him and says, "We just lost the baby." You know, they're almost like she was angry that she had done it. Could you talk a little bit about the Ingrid's search for being complete and the idea of being a whole person with all of these expectations being thrust on her?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, too, because I think she is so just kind of generally unsatisfied with her life and how it's turned out, that she is searching for completeness. That's a good way of putting it, but I'm not sure she ever actually achieves that. She has this path that she hopes to travel and she gets diverted hugely from it, but then struggles, you know, never really, I don't think, fully comes to terms with the life that she's ended up with. She's always kind of battling against it and never accepting of it. And so she probably is always searching for completeness. But also I think she's probably the kind of character that would never find it. And Gil too, you know, they're both kind of dissatisfied characters looking for something. But I think whatever they think they're looking for, if they found it, they'd still be looking for something else beyond that. That's the kind of people they are. And possibly even Flora as well, the daughter. I think maybe only Nan could possibly achieve that. It's a nice way of looking at it, actually.
And Gil specifically, you know, it seems like he is very interested in leaving some kind of legacy. And if he can't do it in his writing, then he'll do it with as many children as he can possibly have. And on the subject of childbirth and birth and rebirth, Ingrid's constant visits to the ocean and the way when she emerges from the ocean is specifically the one time she goes out too far and she almost drowns. And when she resurfaces, she has this newfound look on life. And the idea of rebirth there. What were you going for with Ingrid's, I don't want to say obsession, but her fascination with the ocean and
water. Mm. It was an escape, and not just from, you know, the family that are just kind of at the top of the cliff in the house, but from the land itself, because you're in a completely different environment. It couldn't be more different, you know, that it's a completely different element. You're not touching the earth. You're kind of working with a different element. And I think it makes that is perhaps that we were just talking about completeness. That is the one time when perhaps she does feel at home, even though there's this huge danger, because, you know, the ocean is always dangerous. All sorts of things happen to her when she's swimming. But also it was not just Ingrid's element, it was also the place, the one place that she connected with her daughter Flora, because Flora's also a swimmer and they don't get on generally, even though Ingrid disappears when Flora is about 10, but they swim together, and that's when they do actually connect. That's the one place that they connect in. But I wanted the water, and swimming is very important to me kind of personally. I love swimming in the sea, and the place where the book is set is the place where I go swimming. And I personally kind of like the freedom of it, the actual physical feel of it, but also the kind of mental feel that you're separate from everything, and yet there's also some kind of element of danger, however vague that is.
Right. There's also, you explore the idea of lost youth, and not just in Ingrid giving up her pursuit of her degree, but in Gil's constant quest for, be it alcohol or parties or being surrounded by other people, and then, you know, refusing to get a real job and growing up. Can you talk a little bit about the for lack of a better term, adulting in the book from some of these people?
Yeah, Gil especially. I think Ingrid is forced into it, isn't it? Isn't she really, by motherhood? You know, she has to be, or she tries to be sensible and worries about the money and having enough food and everything in the house for the children. But Gil, yeah, is not very good at it. And yet he states, or his friend states on his behalf near the beginning of the book, that what he really wants is a wife and a family. And I think that's because his family where he was growing up was not a very good one either. And so he's looking for this ideal, you know, of loads of children and everything being wonderful and having a lovely wife at home who looks after him while he just writes his books and is really successful. And for him, it kind of almost works out, except that then his wife disappears. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, he's 40 when we meet him first. And yes, he's drinking and he's having parties and people are surrounding him. I think that's because he's still looking for this wife and family, and not quite knowing how to get it and going about it very badly.
Yeah. And on the topic of being forced into adulthood, there's Nan who, when her mother leaves, is then, because she's older, she's now thrust into the mother role and taking care of Flora. And that puts a rift between the two of them, because Flora doesn't feel like she needs to be mothered by Nan. And the sisterly relationship isn't really a sisterly relationship, right?
No, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Nan, who was also a midwife in that kind of caring role, mm-hmm. Yeah, is forced to look after Flora when Ingrid disappears. And resents it, although she hides it for a long time, and then at the end of this book, it all comes out. Yeah, she's not very happy in that role. And yeah, she's forced into adulthood from a very young age. Although I do also wonder how much is that Nan feeling she should fill that role. She kind of steps into it without anyone particularly asking her to or wanting her to. And in fact, there's a letter where Ingrid asks for that not to happen, but it still does.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because when Nan is first born and Ingrid is taking the train with her, and there doesn't seem to be a connection there, like a mother-daughter connection. She feels very separate, like this is an alien person she's in charge of. But we learn that the two of them are actually so close in terms of personality type and you know, taking on that responsibility when forced to. I found that dynamic interesting.
Yeah. I really wanted to look at that and how motherhood is sometimes forced upon us. I mean, I had my children through choice. It wasn't like that for me, but I didn't fall in love with them when they were babies. I didn't have that overwhelming rush of love. That kind of came as a very, very gradual thing for me. And I wanted to write about that. That was kind of one of the things I really set out to do, about how you can try to be a good mother, even if it's not something that comes very naturally to you. And how we all, well, I'm speaking for myself, but how, you know, even though my children are adults now, I still have that kind of mother guilt that, oh, I should have done this better, I should have done that better when they were younger, I should have not worked, or I should have worked more, or all those kinds of things that I know a lot of women who are mothers feel, and Ingrid feels too, but she believes, you know, we all have moments where our children say to us, I hate you, you're rubbish. Mm-hmm. But Ingrid comes to believe that. And then she, at the end of the book, before she disappears, really, I suppose, she takes that to extremes. She absolutely comes to believe it, that she isn't a very good mother, and the children actually don't need her.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. And you touch on something in this book that I feel like maybe some women are afraid to admit, that and it might be a societal problem, it might just be that it's just not talked about, but the idea that someone doesn't want to be a parent, that Gil is the one who wants mm-hmm. the children and she doesn't, and it's sort of a taboo in certain circles, because, you know, how you're married, why wouldn't you want children? It's offensive when I hear someone ask, you know, well, when are you having children? And, you know, maybe that's not something they ever thought about having. You know, they have dogs and that's enough.
Yeah, that it really is a taboo, that, and not even just those women who are married and perhaps haven't had children yet or don't want children. There's all that. We do seem to talk about that more, but we don't. It's really difficult to talk about. You have children, and do you want them? Mm-hmm. I know it's too late, and obviously, you know, you still hopefully still love them, will care for them, will do everything you can for them, but maybe it's something that it's just not how you imagined, and perhaps we don't talk about it because it is too late. Kind of, what's the point in talking about it? But right. I think it's quite interesting that, you know, there are some women who have had children and think, my life could have been so different. And would it have been a better life?
I'd like to discuss the importance of the books that the letters are left in, because I found myself wondering, are these real books? And why the, obviously there's a tie when you learn the title of the book into as to what, how it relates to the letter that she wrote. But for you, were these real books, and how did you come across them, and what kind of research went into that?
They are all real books. I researched them online, so I don't own them all.
Okay.
Because there are some, I'm just looking up here, there's one that's, because each letter it says where it's placed. So this one was placed in Hand Crochet Creations for the Home, Bedspreads, Luncheon Sets, Scarves, Chair Sets by Bernard Ullman, 1933. No, I don't own that, but it is a real book. Where the letters are hidden, that whole idea really came about by accident as well, that Ingrid had written this letter, and then Flora comes into the room, and she's in a room full of books, and she needs to hide it, and it just seemed kind of logical to hide it in a book. Mm-hmm. And then also the part that I read out in the beginning, from the very beginning, that letter, which actually is Ingrid's last letter, was hidden in a book called Who Has Changed and Who Is Dead by Barbara Cummins, which is one of my favourite books ever. And I just happened to pick that title just because it was in my head. And then I thought, well, this, it's so odd that this title is so appropriate to Ingrid's last letter. And then I thought it would be fun to kind of carry on doing that. And some of the books they're appropriate, and they're books that I actually know and love. So We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson, one mm-hmm. of the letters is in that book, which is one of my favourite books of all time. And it's the lesson that Gil teaches to his students. Then there's also another, there's a book of poetry by Spike Milligan, who was an English comedian who really was known for being funny and for writing humorous poetry. But Small Dreams of a Scorpion is a very sad book, because this Spike Milligan also had quite severe depression. So the book is, it's very sad poetry. And once I'd decided that this is what I was going to do, then sometimes I would just research book titles that seemed appropriate to the contents of Ingrid's letter. And really, I don't always even know exactly what the book is about. I read the précis, but I haven't read the book. So it was kind of based on the title, whether the title was appropriate to the content.
I love how Ingrid had given Gil all the opportunities in the world to learn about her and what made her tick. And he never truly gave her the focus she needed or she deserved. And so it's almost like this final act of defiance to him. I wrote you these letters, and instead of presenting them to you when I leave, I'm going to make you look for them and find me in these books that you treasured more than you treasured our relationship.
Yeah, it is. And I'm not sure what to say. I completely agree. Yeah, that is what she's doing. And she almost kind of doesn't care, will he find them or not? It's kind of too late. It's too late. So
right.
Yeah, there you go.
So tell me about the importance of smell in the book, because smell is important to set the tone of a scene and to give that one extra dimension. But it's almost like you give each smell a color. You talk about like leather and coffee grounds smelling like otter brown. And there's, I can't remember what it was, but it was like the blue of the sea you could smell, like the saltiness. How did that imagery come around? Because that was very unique. I hadn't seen that before, assigning a color to a smell that way.
Well, it's because all those are from Flora's point of view, and Flora has synesthesia, you know, where you see or two senses come together that most people don't have. So she, when she sees a color, she smells and colors are very much linked for her, and she never expresses it, because as I understand, I'm not a synesthetic, but as I understand it, that's just how the world is for them. So quite often they live their lives without realizing that anyone else doesn't have that. So Flora never describes it to anyone else. It's just the reader understands it. But smell is, aside from Flora, is also really important to Ingrid. So her sense of smell is quite well developed, although she doesn't link it with colours. But I was writing the book, and I'm part of a writer's group, and we give work to each other on a monthly basis and then critique it. Mm-hmm. And I was some way through swimming lessons, I can't remember, and I just happened to do this almost by mistake, link a colour and a smell. And one of my friends in this writing group said, you know, oh, do you realise what you've done here? And I thought, I just really like that. And so I kind of played it up, developed it so that's what Flora has.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite descriptive techniques in the book. Since we're on the topic of writing and you writing this book, on page 135, you have this line of dialogue from Gil where he's talking to Richard, and he says, "Fiction is about readers. Without readers, there is no point in books, and therefore they are as important as the author, perhaps more important." Is that something you also believe? Because I'm a writer, and I always hear from people, well, I don't write for other people, I write for myself. But I'm thinking, no, I'm writing to be read. I'm writing to have my words read by someone else. Do you feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Even if it was just one person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I write for my words to be read. And also, I do believe Gil completely there, because I think that if two people read what you've written, even if your descriptions are wonderful and really clear, both those people will see things differently that you've described in the book, because they'll also bring their own history to it, their own prejudices, their own thoughts. And so they'll fill in the gaps. So you could describe a house, but they, if you got them to draw the same house, mm-hmm. they'll draw it differently. So each time I think a book is read, it almost becomes a different book. And it's the reader who creates that. So once the book has been written by the writer and is out there being read, whether it's a manuscript or a published book, each time it becomes something different. And I love that idea. That in a way I've written this one book, but you know, however many people have read it, I have these thousands of books out there.
Right.
Really nice.
Even in our conversation right off the bat, I had seen something in the book that maybe you hadn't explicitly, consciously gone in to write in that way,
exactly.
But I had seen it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is your second book, correct?
Yes.
What is it you learned between writing book one and two? Was there anything new that happened?
I think I learned that I can't plan on my books. However much
you're
I
not
want
an outliner.
To. I'm not an outliner. I kind of tried that and you know, I might have spent I don't know however long trying to write a plan or an outline, and as soon as I started writing that kind of went out the window. But I did learn something stuff about myself and how I write, and that I am quite disciplined and I can finish something. And however much of a mess a first draft is, that for me, it's all in the editing, and that's what I enjoy doing. And if I can just get to the end of the first draft, then maybe everything will be okay. I don't want to say it definitely will, because who knows with book three and four and wherever I'm going. Mm-hmm. But certainly with these two, the first book that I had published was the first book I had ever written. And so I really didn't know what I was doing. And I thought that the first draft should have been better, but actually it all worked out in the editing. And so that's a great thing to learn for me. That's just how I work. But it's very reassuring that when I'm writing and I think this is absolutely terrible, mm-hmm. you know, that to just tell myself, keep going. You'll get there in the end.
Right, exactly. You have to get the words down, otherwise you have nothing to edit. And it's funny because I had this conversation with Chris Holm on my last episode, and he was telling me that editing is his favorite part of the process. And I was like, I can't get behind that. It's all about the discovery and you know, learning the new things as you're going and getting, you know, discovering the characters, like you said, and getting that first draft done. Like, nothing feels better to me than getting that first draft done. And the editing to me is like pulling teeth. I just,
it's
my least favorite part of the process, but it's necessary to have a solid book. But
yeah, I think you're more common from having talked to lots of writers in what you like. I think most people prefer the discovery and don't like the editing because mm-hmm. they feel like, oh, the creation's done and now it's just kind of tidying things up. No, but it's a playing with words that I love doing. That's what I like. The discovery is painful. I have to bribe myself to sit at my desk and write the first draft.
But do you find yourself, by the end of the process, just not wanting to see these characters ever again?
No. I find it really hard to give them up.
Oh, wow,
no.
Okay.
Yeah, they stay with me for a long time.
I hate my book by the time I consider it done. I just never want to see it again.
I don't read them again once they're published, because I just know I'll find some things that I will go,
it's never complete in the author's eyes.
No.
Tell me about your writing group. How long have you been there, and have you always been a part of a writing group before you got published?
I've just turned 50, and I started writing when I was 40. And a few years, I was writing some short stories, and a couple of years after that, I started to do, I did an MA in creative writing, or an MFA, as you call it in America. And the writing group came out of that. So I did it part-time over 2 years, and when I'd finished it, although there were loads of things that were great about it, one of the best things was finding some like-minded people who are also in the same position as me and setting out writing their first drafts of their first books. So we met as a group, and we've been meeting ever since. Probably is about 6 years that we've been meeting once a month. I'm not sure I've even missed a month in those 6 years. And we swap up to 3,000 words each month and read each other's. There's now only one other person who was on my MA with me. Other people have kind of come and gone. There's 10 of us now, and we meet each month, and it's so brilliant. Just for that early look at something and getting feedback, so good.
Do you workshop the first draft or parts of the first draft, or do you wait until you've edited a little bit of it?
Well, when I write my first draft, I write forward and then I edit a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time I finished what I call the first draft, it has been edited to a certain extent. I think there's no point in workshopping something that's really, really rough, that you know has lots of mistakes and things you want to change, because all that will happen is that your critique partners will say, oh, you need to change this, and you'll be saying, yes, I know, I know. So it's better to submit something that's been slightly edited just to really get some proper feedback.
It's funny because I used to think the same thing. Giving the first draft away, especially in its roughest state, is a mistake. And then I ended up giving the first couple of chapters of my last book to a beta reader, and I asked her for any feedback. And she came back and said, this plot point you have hanging over everything that you're sort of using as a you're using it as a gimmick almost. And so if you took this out, it would be so much stronger. And she was absolutely right.
Yeah.
I was grateful for that early feedback before I got too far into the weeds.
Yes, that there is something to say for that. I went to a kind of writing retreat when I was at about 30,000 words of swimming lessons. And we had a writing tutor with us who was giving us feedback and kind of helping us work. And the book at that point, about 30,000 words, was all written from Gil's point of view. And she said, maybe we want to hear from Ingrid and Flora. And I cut out about 20,000, went back to 10,000 words. And so that all the really that remains of that now is that very first chapter where I was reading some from Gil's point of view. The rest is obviously Ingrid's and Flora's point of view. And she was so right. So the same kind of thing happened, yeah.
You said you hadn't started writing until after 40. What sparked the change and what made you want to write?
I've been doing some art projects with my husband or partner, as he was then. Miranda July, do you know her?
Yes.
Yes. So we'd been doing a book that she wrote called Learning to Love You More, where she had invited people from around the world to do various art projects and then submit photos of them for her website. And some of those were actually quite challenging. The one I often quote is Tim. We kind of took them in turns, and he did one where he made a one-person protest sign which said, less driving, more walking. And he went and stood in the middle of a four-lane highway in front of all the cars while I took photographs.
Oh, wow.
And so we were doing things which were not ever so challenging, but certainly kind of out of our comfort zone. And we did most of them in this book and submitted them. And yet I still really liked the challenge, and I was looking for something else. And I came across what was called a short story slam in my local library, which was an event where you could sign up to write a short story, which had to last 5 minutes, and you had to read it out in front of a paying audience. And so I signed up, having never written anything since I had left school at 18. And I wrote several short stories, and I think I enjoyed having written and rather than the writing. And that's when I decided to sign up for the MA.
That's great.
So that's how it all started, yeah.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. In searching for an agent and a book deal, did you find more difficulty because you hadn't had that lifetime of credits and short story publications and all that? Was it more difficult for you to get published?
Actually, I was incredibly lucky, and it was relatively easy. I got an agent very quickly. I'd had some success with the short stories by then. I'd won a couple of quite big competitions and was able to kind of put that in the covering letter. And the fact that I'd done the MA or was in the middle of the MA meant that I was kind of committed to doing some writing, even though I had started very late. And submitted the first draft of Our Endless Number, or a draft of Our Endless Number Days, and got an agent very quickly. And then worked with her on some edits, and she sent it out to publishers. And it went to auction. So it all happened amazingly quickly and brilliantly for me. It wasn't too much difficulty at all.
You're like the fifth person I've talked to who has the miraculous getting an agent and a publishing deal story. Because I always read, I know. This person had 300 rejections before they got their deal. And everyone I talk to now is like, no, I got my agent very quickly.
Oh no, I always feel guilty telling this story because I know you might have talked to five people, but I know it doesn't generally happen like this. It is much harder. But yeah, it's been relatively easy for me. But
it's just my luck to talk to them on this show. I get the people who had no problem getting a deal.
Yeah. But who knows? You know, this writing job is fickle, so I'm just counting my blessings, to be here, to be published, to still be writing. It's just great.
It's terrific, and it's very well deserved. The book is phenomenal.
Oh, thank you very much.
You've been doing a lot of touring and signings and readings as well. How has that been?
Oh, great fun. I love meeting readers. That is one of the perks of it for me. I mean, you sit down for a couple of years writing a book, not really seeing anybody, and then it's published and you get to go out and meet people, which is absolutely lovely. And I like that sociable side of things. I know some writers, they write because they're kind of introverted, and I like the combination where I can sit and write and then at times I can go out. So I've just been doing all sorts of things. Just come back from a little tour of New York and visiting bookshops. And
I saw that. You were in my neck of the woods.
And is that where you're from?
Yeah. I'm in New Jersey, but I work in New York City. And when I saw that, I it had been too late. I didn't have a chance to make the time to come out and say hello. I wish I had. Yeah. But I saw that. I was like, I missed it.
Yeah. Oh, it was great. And I'd never been to New York before. So it was wonderful. And going to places that perhaps, on a normal holiday tourist trip, that you wouldn't necessarily go, because I was going to some quite, well, independent bookshops, which were all over the place.
There's no shortage in New York.
No, there are loads. And the book people are all so lovely. Booksellers are just the nicest people.
And yeah, I had talked to Uli Boyta-Cohen, who runs the Instagram and blog Subway Book Review, where she takes photos of people on the subway reading books and asks them about it. She had actually, when I had interviewed her, she had done one for me as well, which was really, really cool. But she said to me that New York, there is no more literary city than New York City. There's just, in her experience, New York is where it's at for readers.
Yeah, it was great. Really, really good.
Now, does your publisher help with a lot of that, or are you essentially footing the bill for your tours and your readings and your signings? I'm always curious about how involved the publisher is on this.
Publisher involved all the way. My US publisher is Tin House, and yeah, they paid for me to go out to New York, and they organized the whole tour, put me up, flew me over, all that kind of stuff.
That's great.
They don't pay for my time. But, you know, I had an amazing time, so I'm not going to say no. And the same goes in the UK. My publisher is Penguin, and they do all the organising, and they'll often pay my travel expenses if I'm speaking at a bookshop or whatever. Sometimes the literary event will pay. It depends on how all the costs work out. So I'm not kind of out of pocket, but if I need to be at home writing, I'm obviously not doing that. So in a way, I'm kind of losing some time, which might equate to money in the end. But but I also understand that a book needs promoting. You know, I worked in marketing for 23 years before I gave that up, and I now write full time. So I do, although it was marketing completely different things to books, I do understand the necessity of it. Plus, I enjoy it, so it's not a problem.
I was talking to another podcaster yesterday about, and he's someone who interviews podcasters about their show, and he was asking me where the origin for Covered came from and what I had hoped to achieve with it. And I said, you know, it's so hard for authors to get their books out there, especially if they're mid-list authors who don't have the full support of their publisher behind them for marketing purposes. Like, for a lot of people, unless you're James Patterson or Stephen King or Lee Child, you know, you're sort of on your own when it comes to marketing. It comes down to you. So if I can give them an outlet to talk about their book and maybe sell a few more copies, I feel like I'm doing my job.
It's people like you that writers need, definitely.
So before we go, I'm curious, what are you reading right now?
I really ought to know. I'm just terrible at remembering names. I bought quite a few books when I was in America, thinking that, you know, trying to find ones that I couldn't necessarily get over here. Oh, and the name's just gone from me. It's kind of like a hard-boiled detective story. So that's what I'm reading right now, but I'm not much help if I can't tell you the name.
That's okay. I love, one thing this show has given me is the opportunity to reach out to publishers who put out books that I might not be able to get here also. For example, Karis Bray, who I interviewed about her book, The Museum of You, I reached out to the publisher for a copy because it's not published in the U.S. And that was, I was thrilled to grab that because that was such a good book as well.
Yeah, Karis Bray's writing is lovely. I've done quite a few events with her and a song for Izzy Bradley, her first book. It was absolutely gorgeous.
That's terrific. Well, Claire, thank you so much for coming on today. This is wonderful.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been great to talk to you.
Where can people find you online? And do you have any readings coming up soon?
Yes, all my readings coming up, though, are in the UK. And people can find them all on my website, which is www.clairefuller.co.uk. And there's a list of events there. I'm on Twitter, which is Claire Fuller 2, the number 2, and I'm on Instagram, which is, I think it's Writer Claire Fuller. If it's not, it's Claire Fuller Writer.
I'll put the link in the show notes so people don't follow the wrong person.
Yeah, so I'm on those three most of the time. Yeah.
This has been Covered with special guest Claire Fuller. Links to Claire's books and all other materials discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey. If you're able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for our beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to FeedPress and Nocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.
Hello, this is Alex Knight from Hologram Radio, here to tell you about a fun new podcast that we recently launched called Serial Sommelier. Each week, David Kahlo and a guest select a random episode of a much-beloved 1970s and 1980s Saturday morning cartoon series, review the episode, have some laughs, and of course, pair the perfect sugar cereal with it. Subscribe to Serial Sommelier today in iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and of course, wherever you can find your favorite podcasts.